turning back. I'm living just another day. I'll take my time. Hi, everybody. How are you today? Thank you so much for coming back to the Go See Talk podcast experience as we expand our Bandcamp interview series. Oh my gosh, we've got somebody at the top of the pyramid, pantheon, top of the list, the ladder that we've been climbing to for years, ever since we first listened to his music. Highway superstar. His name is Alex Karlinski. When you hit play, do you like mixing up your music? Do you like mashups? Do you like things that just, you know, different ingredients that make the songs extra special? Well, if you like synthwave, if you like shredding guitar, if you like 88 keys, if you like Pat Metheny, holy crap, Highway Superstar is your ticket to ride. We are excited to welcome our next guest on the show. Alex, before we get into it, I want to say thank you for being on the show and making such sweet, synthy, sexy music. But how are things in your world?
So, first of all, Mark, it's an absolute pleasure to thank you so much for having me here. It's a complicated time we live in, I'll say that. It's a stressful situation at times politically, and it affects our daily life and my daily life as well. So, right now we are kind of in a tough spot, but I'm hopeful that we'll get over it in time. It's been a rough year, not gonna lie, but we're looking ahead towards the future, and I truly hope and wish for things to calm down, but I also kind of wish for us to do what's necessary to get the safety that we deserve as well.
Yes, you totally deserve it. So let's send some good feelings. Let's send some silky smooth synth sensation out in the universe. And then hopefully everyone will harmonize. Everything will come together a lot like Alex's contributions to the musical universe and his wonderful arrangements and compositions. But Alex, we usually like to start with a huge grapefruit question. We're big fans of Back to the Future. We're going to go back in time. Take us to little Alex's daily life at, say, 5 years old. When did you first want to throw your hands on some keys? When did you first put a game controller in your hand? What about the electronic soundscape first grabbed you and said, "We're gonna do this, buddy. Get in the car. Let's go."
So, if we're talking about like my early childhood, so I was born in Belarus, which was back then part of the Soviet Union, the Soviet bloc. Music's been always a part of my life. My mom is a piano teacher. She still teaches to this day. And kind of my first real steps in music was kind of listening to classical music, listening to pupils that came to our house to study music with my mom. And one of the fun stories she used to tell is that from early age, I had an ear for when things sound good and when things sound kind of off or off tune or wrong. And I used to be very amused by people that didn't do their homework properly. They used to come to my mom's house and they would play the wrong notes, etc. And I would ask my mom to play the funny music again. So that's kind of my earliest musical memories. Soon enough, at the age of five-ish, I started studying piano as well. So obviously from my mom, but also from other teachers as well, because obviously there's only so much a parent can teach you, and kind of the relationship would be as a student to a teacher. Kind of. So yeah, it's tough when it's your parent. So my mom, pretty early on, she decided I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to take you to a piano teacher. So I was studying music since the early 80s, I think. And you know, I'm still studying. I mean, I keep finding out new things that I like. I keep expanding my musical horizons. I try new things on the instrument. So it's a lifelong process, really. As far as video games, I would say the first experiences I had with video games are like old IBM and XT computers. 4-color monitors and things like that. I remember the NES from my kind of early childhood when we came here to Israel when I was 7. So yeah, video games were a big part of my life as well since early childhood.
Well, I want to go back to what you said about practicing and still learning music, because, you know, in the medical profession, doctors are still practicing. Nobody gets it right. It's always a constant evolution. And even making a parallel to video games, there's stuff that I never beat as a child. And even as an adult, I still can't beat. So that's the thing. Some of the challenges are real. The video games are fun. They draw you in. And I had an Apple IIgs, and I remember it had more than 4 colors, but it's funny. I watched War Games when I was a kid, and I actually changed the color of the interface on the Apple IIgs to look like it did on War Games. So it was like black with that kind of a midnight electric green. But you know, I mean, we're all products of what we take in. What were some of your favorite video games from either computers or systems?
Well, let's see. You're gonna laugh, but yeah, but like one of the earliest memories of computer games for me was the ski game for the Windows 3.11 with the Yeti at the end. When you kind of go downhill, you hit obstacles, etc. Then at some point, there's this snow monster that comes in and kind of tries to eat you. So there was that. What else on the same kind of same ballpark? There was kind of the way you control a moon lander and you try to land on the quote unquote moon. So these sort of stuff. But yeah, later on, the classic NES games. So I do remember Mario. Mega Man was a huge thing I really liked, for the soundtrack as well. So kind of the Oriental Japanese kind of composing type of things that chiptune guys emulate to this day, I think. So that was a big inspiration and kind of tunes that stayed in my mind for many years. Let's see. Classic NES type of stuff. Contra, obviously. And a bunch of PC gaming as well. So like classic point and click adventures from the 90s and those are the kind of my earliest gaming memories, I'd say.
You know, I feel like from everything you said, we could just have a whole different podcast from music. We can go into, I played Mixed Up Mother Goose, which was a point and click adventure on the 2GS, Space Quest, played the original Space Quest on the Apple, and then got into the 90s. Oh yeah, point and click was Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Sam and Max, a lot of those Lucasfilm games sort of not pioneer, but they definitely cornered the market on a lot of point and clicks. Do you remember one called Prisoner of Ice, which was a kind of mid-90s?
I do not. I do remember Mixed Up Mother Goose, though. I think that was my first point and click adventure. It was also kind of kids oriented. There's pretty much you run around the map for like these little errands, like fetch this for that, fetch that one for this one. And then you kind of slowly complete all the different kind of errands. And then you pretty much complete the game. But yeah, that was a good game, and it had a good sense of kind of accomplishment in terms of rewarding you for the little things that you've done. So it was built really nicely. So I remember it fondly from my early childhood. But also, there's a memory I have, and that's a funny story actually, from before that, from the Soviet Union. So when I was about 5 years old, something like that, my grandpa was a keeper of, like that was his job. He was a keeper of the local arcade in the Soviet Union.
No way.
It didn't have a lot of, it didn't have any Western or Japanese games like Pac-Man or Street Fighter or Space Invaders, etc. It only had these old Soviet machines that were, they weren't digital, they were all analog, and like one of them, I'm sure that fans of this show that kind of are into classic arcade, etc., and they research for the old stuff and they encounter the Soviet stuff. So there was this game where you had a periscope and you would fire at submarines, and you'd have these models of boats and submarines that are kind of floating around the screen, and they're all kind of cardboard made, and then you just launch missiles at them or torpedoes. You'd also have something like a game that's called, I think it was sort of like a hunting theme. So you would have a rifle and you would just shoot like animals that are also kind of cardboardy figures that kind of pop on the screen. So yeah, so I would do that. And that place was usually packed with teenagers, and my grandpa would just take me by the hand and he would just spread everyone away, and then you'd say like, hey, my kid's playing now, there you go, go ahead, play as much as you want.
Perks so of being the proprietor, that's great.
Yeah, so that's a fun memory I have related to gaming and arcade.
Okay, well, yeah, I there's where I live in Texas, there's a free play arcade, so you sort of you pay your admission, however much it is to get in, and then every game is unlimited plays and, you know, no free continues. So I was playing this crossbow game, and it reminded me of Mixed Up Mother Goose and Space Quest. And I think it's funny the amount of patience we had to watch a digitized person trek themselves across the screen. It could take 4 minutes to go, dok, dok, dok. But at the time I was spellbound because I was, you know, trying to process the idea of what I'm doing with my hands and a keyboard and a mouse is telling this person to do this. It's a command. And you know, your brain obviously makes so much more of the pixels and the resolution than was there, you know, at face value, but it just shows you how immersive the electronic environment is. And that's one of the reasons I really want to talk to you about your mindset in the electronic soundscape. Cause, you know, as your mother was a piano teacher, I don't ask this question a lot, but I always think about it. You know, I know you have 88 keys, you have 6 strings, you have 3 keys on a trumpet, but you know, you can actually physically touch that. But what you can do in a digital landscape, soundscape, is infinite, you know? And so I'm just curious about how your foray into that world beyond the screen, world beyond the physical keys, you know, where you came up with that stuff. So we'll get to that in a little, but this is fun. This is fun. Alice in Chains t-shirt. Talk about that. Was that a concert shirt?
It's not a concert shirt. It's actually one of those recent band t-shirts that you can pick up at a random clothing store that, you know how the trend goes now that you have Nirvana shirts and stuff like that, that are kind of major chains. They put out new collections with band shirts, and I'm like, well, that's just the thing for me, because I don't need to venture far to grab shirts of bands that I like, and Alice in Chains happens to be my favorite grunge band. So you gotta have an Alice in Chains t-shirt. I mean,
you're a man in a box talking about the man in a box in a t-shirt. So
there's it now.
Well, I was reason I was asking. Yes, I know I'm very familiar with the big box chains that do. You know, I was in Target last weekend, and it's hilarious, I think, to see a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles T-shirt for kids these days, more than 25 years after the original show was on the cartoon and all those toys, and it's just manifested and stayed in public consciousness. So it's just funny to see. I was wearing that stuff when I was 6 or 7. So fun times.
Yeah. On the other hand, you see a teenager with a Nirvana shirt and you're like, name 3 songs, right? Name 1 song.
Well, it's so funny. I was at work yesterday, and this is, I guess, kismet. Somebody was saying that I guess they're in their early 20s, and they go, I've never even heard of Nirvana or Pearl Jam. And I just thought to myself, and I wasn't even in the conversation, or I would have audibly you know, expressed a sigh, but in my mind, I just thought to myself, what is happening? How old, how dinosaur-like am I am right now? Did I just crust up and get covered in scales?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because the way we look at the 80s and even the 90s now, that was the way that in the 80s they would look at greaser culture from the 50s and try to emulate that. And you would have like an 80s sounding music, but if you kind of strip it down to the basic, it's like 50s blues and things like that, and Grease the Musical and all these kind of stuff. That was like a look back, and even Back to the Future. That's a look back to the 50s and the 60s, much like we're doing now with the 90s. So yeah, it's just moving forward. I wonder whether in like 20 years from now, people will be trying to emulate like early 2000s and the 2010s.
I don't doubt it one bit. I was actually having a conversation with a coworker about 2 weeks ago, and it's something that I've been thinking about. I think that, well, you mentioned 30 years. I think that in the things that I've noticed, I feel like that there is this shift every 20 years. So in the 80s, people were in love with the 60s. In the 2010s, people were in love with the 80s. And I think that, my dad says, what's old is new again. I know he didn't come up with that phrase, but when I first heard that, I thought to myself, what are you talking about? And then you watch cars go from being very sharp edges, and then they round. And then years later, they start to get sharp again, and they round. And so you're finding this cycle. And even now people are looking at, well, it's funny, I bought five or six cassettes this year alone. I mean, granted, they were older music that I grew up with, but I never thought that I would have a cassette in my hand again after I threw them all away in the 90s. And so people are using, dumb phones or clever phones instead of smartphones. So there's this shift that I find every 20 years. You sort of someone, gets into or grunge rock or hair metal, and they're like, it's the greatest thing ever. And like, it's only because you never heard it before. We've loved it for 40 years. So
Yeah, no, there's definitely stuff that I things are old that I'm getting into. Like I don't know. I can say that my greatest discovery in the past, like maybe 10 years, was Steely Dan. I never
okay.
got Steely Dan. I started getting it only very much later in my life, which was the kind of the from the early 30s till now. Now I'm in my early 40s. So yeah, that's my greatest musical discovery, I think. But at the same time, I feel like I'm discovering something new for me. I'm treading a ground that was treaded many, many times before by many, many musicians, many different people, many fans, etc. So I fully realize that this is my personal discovery that a lot of people have made before me, granted. So yeah.
Well, congratulations for reeling in the years, Alex. We're happy to have you in the Steely Dan train.
Oh, thank you. Don't lose my number.
why don't we go to my number one? I'm just going to say, I'm holding in my hands, for those who can't see this podcast, I'm holding in my hands Highway Superstars. Is this your second album?
It is. And yeah, it's very kind of you.
Endgame has, I want to let's go on a personal journey for a second. So, pandemic happened. For those who made it out, kudos, your stamina, your ability to get a booster or a shot has helped you heal and move on. For those who didn't make it, we still think about you, but it was a tough time. And I think the thing that made me get through it personally was music. I think that's when Bandcamp really became my go-to source for, as Alex was saying, discovering music. I found a multitude of artists, whether it was synthwave or indie rock or African funk, all these things. So I'm going to pick this back up. Highway Superstar was my sort of lifeline in during that time, amongst a bunch of other things. So Alex, I first want to say, you happen to be one of the coolest people I've never met until now. Let's talk about your style, your look. Again, I want to go back to the avatar of you holding that badass keyboard with the handle. I don't know if it's a gun or Cloud's sword from Final Fantasy VII, but How did you get into this world of highway superstarring? Take us to the danger zone.
So back in 2012, I was just out of a band that I tried playing with. It didn't quite work out in the sense of we had really good songs. It was an AOR kind of 80s type of band. We had good songs, but nothing really came out of it in the sense of we tried perfecting them and more, but we eventually never got to the point where we're releasing stuff. And I thought to myself, well, I've been in bands all my life, and I'm a huge metal guy, and I've been in metal bands for as long as I can remember. And I thought, well, why do I need more people to make decisions for me? Why do I need to get a lot of people involved in my decision-making process? I think I'm fully capable of making stuff happen on my own, both musically and in terms of my own personal brand. So I thought, why not? This is kind of the perfect moment for me to kind of take everything that I picked up along the way and kind of funnel that into my own personal project. And I didn't really know what I was doing at the start. I had the musical direction sort of figured out from the get-go, because I was very inspired by things that were coming out back at that time, like the Drive soundtrack and like the French Touch Revolution and Justice and Daft Punk and Kavinsky and all those acts that were taking nostalgia but turning it into something that is completely different. And I started at first by covering songs, so I did a bunch of reworks for familiar things. Some of it is on YouTube, I think. But before I knew it, I started composing on my own, and my initial thought was try to get as closer to the 80s sound authentically as I possibly could with the means that I have. So a couple of synthesizers, some in the box stuff, and I kind of started creating tracks for the heck of it. I wasn't quite considering like making it big or like building a name for myself or having an album out. I wasn't thinking that far, but as this went along and I started releasing tracks, individual tracks, and people started responding to that slowly but surely. It was the golden era of SoundCloud. It was back at the time that like music blogs were kind of on the decline, but not quite. Some of them were quite powerful still. There were a couple of blogs that did pick up my music. One of them that I really have to shout out on this show is the Synthetics blog. So when my music started getting out there, and people started responding to it, I realized that it's a good. I have something good here. So I started working towards the first album, and that, in combination of like an alignment of stars in terms of online communities, a bunch of Facebook groups that kind of had a gathering of like graphic designers and musicians and the audience as well. It was all kind of a big melting pot that created what we now know as synthwave or retrowave. We didn't really have a name for it back then. But we had the vibe and we had the visual imagery and we had the musicality, yeah, me as well, inside all of that melting pot. I think that's where in late 2013, Take My Time was out, on Rosso Corsa Records, which was one of the strongest labels. It was kind of a bucket list for me. I really wanted to work with them. And the way that happened was I pretty much bugged Mike, who was Michael from Miami Nights 1984. I used to talk to him a lot, etc., until it kind of came to the point of, well, are you going to release my music? Like, yeah, sure. Of course. So I'm very happy that that ended up happening. Yeah, Russell Corso was definitely a dream coming true to work with and release music as Highway Superstar at. So these two albums, that and Endgame that followed up, both were out on Rosso. So yeah, absolutely thrilled with that fact.
Well, I think affirmation or accomplishment, they mean a lot more when it comes outside of yourself. You know, you might think something's good, or your parents might be like, good job, Alex. But, you know, for a label to go, we love your stuff and we're going to share it with the world. I mean, that's, yeah. Congratulations on that. That's pretty awesome. How was the buzz in your head at that point? Were you exploding with energy or like, holy cow?
Yeah, so at that point, I was very prolific. I did a lot of remixes and standalone tracks, and there was the album, and there was the album that followed it. A lot of collaborations with other artists. I'm really fond of collaborating with other people. I like having different musical directions within my music and being a part of other people's music. I find that process to be personally very satisfying. And I really like kind of drawing on the musical energy of other artists. Personally, it makes me happy. So back at the time, a lot of that was happening. Yeah, it was quite a fulfilling time. It was an exciting time. It was buzzing.
Well, one of the other huge, I'm going to say huge because I love their music as well, is Ultra Boss, who is a similar synth wave. You guys even have maybe a connection. Is it Sebastian Gumpel? Is that, I'm saying that right?
Yeah, so Sebastian is definitely our connection, though we've been chatting before, regardless of Sebastian as well. So yeah, Ultra Boss is great. I haven't talked to him in quite a while, though, which is quite a shame, but he's out there and I'm out there. We occasionally exchange messages, so yeah.
You know, I think it's really cool that that happens because, as you mentioned, people were, you know, finding themselves in common language or common connection with without even maybe knowing it just by virtue of what their interests were. But I like looking through the credits on things and in my head making connections. Like, even though we're across the globe and even though it seems like a small community, I like seeing these things that in my mind just go, these guys are friends, you know, or maybe not, but just the fact that there's connections and solo artists that they both work with, and it makes it feel like a community. So from the outsider's perspective as the consumer, I think it's fun to look at those things on the credits.
Yeah, so one of the great takeaways for me is the lifelong friends I've made within this genre of music since, again, back then and now with Instagram and Facebook being the way it is, etc., it's not quite as buzzing as it used to be or bustling as it used to be back then. But from that period of time, I made so many good friends, and I would probably shout out to a few of them, which are Sunglasses Kid, which is Ed, is a sweet, sweet guy, and Mitch Murder, who I talk to on the daily. A lot of folks that I've had the opportunity to meet when traveling for shows abroad and performing abroad, which are so Future Cop and Wave Shaper and Robert Parker and Forêt Devant, just to name a few.
You're speaking my language. I have to say that one of my favorite tracks of yours, probably an artist you haven't named yet, is Frankenmusik, By My Side. I love that song. And I was curious, is it slated to be part of an album? Because you have, if I'm not mistaken, you do have some standalone tracks that aren't part of a collection. So how do those, manifest, whether it's 10 or 12 tracks you want to put on an album versus something that can just be a single and sit by itself?
Well, for me, it's kind of, I wouldn't say it's a set process, but there's definitely periods when I feel like a certain critical mass of tracks that I've completed are sort of corresponding with each other to the point that we can call it a release if I do X or Y or Z. So for example, on and it happened pretty much throughout every release I've made, all of the three full lengths I have, I had like a bunch of completed tracks, and I felt like, wow, so if these are all kind of in the same vibe, so if I do a few more, we can call this an album. And in the sense that I'm not chasing albums per se, I'm chasing music. So if there's something that is complete now, or musical piece, etc., that I feel like it's a great opportunity for me to put it out there, I'll do it. But if there's like a bunch of them that are kind of complete, I would think to myself, well, this is probably a good time for a release, etc. That's probably one of the reasons I don't have like a scheduled release date in my mind, at least. Some artists like to put out a release every year, every couple of years or so, but for me, it's not a set process. And there's definitely a changing period of time between albums. And in between, I try to put out some more music out there, definitely. So there will be a steady flow of music for people that like to listen to my stuff. Because yeah, it's definitely important, especially in today's world where people tend to have somewhat of a shorter attention span due to social media and the way we consume content through our phones and through our other devices. It's important to have a steady flow of creative material that is coming out. I feel that as a creator, I can't say that I'm true to my word and actually making that happen all the time, because there's definitely drier periods, there's definitely more prolific periods. But I do tend to have some stuff out in between albums, just to keep listeners engaged.
It is a breadcrumb trail that always leads you back to Highway Superstar. Well, I love the way you put that, because if you'd have more of an organic workflow as opposed to, say, maybe an internal barometer mandating you need to do this now, or maybe a label being overbearing and, kind of wringing music out of you, it won't feel as put together. But that's what I love about Endgame, just because it does feel like a vibe, and it is so dynamic that you really don't have the same experience through the album the same time each time, because you do have highs and lows and Kasumi's theme. And I'm gonna jump to one of my favorites on another album. Let's see, All Around the World, Hoo Ha. I remember during the pandemic, shortly after, I was just in my car all the time, even to the point where I went out to dinner with my family, and my daughter, who was 6 at the time, when was dancing with her friends, all the other ladies going, "Yo, yo, yo," she made a dance to that song, which I thought was super charming. I wish I would have videoed
That
it. But I love the creative energy you put into it. And as I said at the top of the show, I mean, it feels like video game music times, Pat Metheny at other times. Other times you just come out swinging and you just don't stop. So don't really know where the next question's gonna go. I just wanted to praise you and say how awesome your music is. But That's really it for now.
That's very kind of you. I really, really appreciate that. Well, yeah, there's been a bunch of stuff that happened since Endgame, including the pandemic. And I mean, we talked about the creative process and the importance of keeping the momentum going. So yeah, it doesn't work great all of the time. If we talk about the pandemic, it pretty much killed the live show momentum for me, etc. Especially since for every show abroad, I really need to catch a plane from Israel. So that kind of went downhill after the pandemic and hasn't quite returned to its former self, so I feel. But yeah, that's part of the game, and that's part of the equation of being an artist, I would say. So yeah, hopefully for things to get better as time goes by.
Well, I tell you, one thing that gets better as time goes by is listening to some of the guitar solos. I see five guitars behind you right now. At what point did you learn to play? And at what point do you turn to somebody like Jesse Bullitt or Hugh Marone and say, make this better? What would you do to this track to really send it to the stratosphere?
Right. So definitely guitar solos are a my kind of my stopping point, because there's a limit to what I can do on guitar. And I started learning guitar when I was 18, 19-ish. To be honest, I'm completely self-taught. I'm not following any tutorials, etc. I just play and play and play until I get stuff right. And I've come to a point at this time of my life when I'm fairly confident in my skills to the point that I can make stuff happen as I record them. I may not have the exact line or having the specifics of what I hear in my head, but I would kind of spend enough time on the instrument to make stuff happen in the way that I envision it, to the point that I can record it and be happy with the result. And it's been happening with increasingly elaborated guitar parts, for me at least, maybe not from a true guitarist point of view, because I still consider myself a keyboard player after all. But as a non-guitarist, I still kind of came up, found myself with five guitars in my studio. That's kind of the stuff that end up happening when you're a musician. You just accumulate more and more gear.
It looks good on camera, though, by the way. You know, it just looks impressive.
I do love my guitars, though. but at the point of where you need to have a blaring guitar solo 300 miles per hour, that's kind of where you would turn to a guitar player that is a virtuoso. And yeah, definitely Hugh is one of them, one of the greatest guitar players I've met. And Jesse Bullitt, who's a longtime collaborator of mine, has been in most of the Highway Superstar guitar oriented tracks. So yeah, he lives in Israel. So he would just drive over and record some stuff. We would sit for a few hours. We'd drink some, we'd make some music, we'll hang. So yeah, absolutely a blast. And yeah, guitars, I mean, what's not to like?
Well, I'm pretty sure this is having a little fun here, but in a song like Castaway, if you and Hugh were cast away on an island, I'm pretty sure you guys would keep each other entertained just with guitar solos. So that sounds like fun.
Absolutely.
Well, talk about Contraband. That was an album that kind of came out of nowhere and it's gotten really good press and vibes. So what were some of your thoughts? Where I'm going with this before that is when you have a group of songs, I don't know if I'm making this up, but it seems like when an artist puts a collection of songs together on an album, I think they have three choices to really make an impact. It's either the first song, the third song, or the very last song to just sort of say, you know, like dynamite, so to speak. So what's your thought process? Do you want the first one, the third one, or the 10th one to just be the, holy crap, I'm so glad I own this album?
Well, I would say that the journey is important. Sometimes it's even more important than a standalone track and the place it's in the actual playlist. I'm like that. I would collect a bunch of tracks and then I would spend a lot of time organizing them in the order that I feel has the best flow for at least for from a listener's perspective, in my opinion, for that particular album, and for a listener to have the tracks make sense as they progress throughout the track list. But yeah, it's definitely having the second or third track of with a track that makes a lot of impact is it's definitely a thing. These often kind of laws that you have in your head or rules on how to make a track list happen, they kind of differ from musician to musician, but we definitely have some or I at least spent a lot of time considering also for the latter part of the album how to keep the listener entertained or keeping their attention. So I try to have a healthy combination of both instrumentals and vocal tracks throughout the first half of the album. And I'm talking halves here because I'm also trying to be mindful of how that album would sound on vinyl, where you have a side A and a side B.
Okay. Yeah, I get that.
Of a good sense of rhythm and make sense to the listener when they're listening to a specific side of the album. Because you put the vinyl on your turntable, you press play, or you put the needle, you drop the needle, it starts playing, and then you're listening to it in some remote place in sense of, you know, like you go away, you listen to it, maybe you cook something, maybe you're on your phone or you're on your sofa, maybe you're reading the lyrics sheet, but the point is that you'll have a couple two halves of an album that are somewhat evenly constructed, and that will kind of harmonize with each other.
That is awesome thought process. It reminds me of something that I just learned earlier this year. Are you a fan of Cowboy Bebop by any chance?
Well, I started watching the show probably this year. I'm ashamed to say that I haven't finished. It's somewhere in my Netflix watch list. Obviously, talking about the animation, not the live action.
Yeah, which doesn't exist, by the way. We did on Goosey Talk. We do not acknowledge that in any aspect.
Okay, strike that.
But where I was going with this is one of the things that made this the show legendary is the jazz music from Yoko Kanno and Seatbelts, and so they put out an album this year which was curated by Yoko specifically, speaking to what you just mentioned, the idea that when you turn the record over, you know, the first four, five, six tracks are its unique listening experience, and then when you flip it over, it's curated, so it's a different adventure, a different journey. And so when you have the two XLP, you basically have four adventures, so to speak. And I thought that that's really great, the way you're echoing that in a parallel to it, so that there is a rhythm and it is balanced. So dang, musicians just they know what they're doing, don't they?
We don't necessarily always know what we're doing. A lot of experimenting and things that don't quite work in our paths that we kind of need to have the energy to kind of clear off our desk and kind of keep the things that work. Not the easiest task, I have to say. Not always.
Well, going back to Steely Dan, I was actually picking up more of a Michael McDonald vibe from you with the beard. I have to congratulate you on how luxuriant that is. Your voice, you do the writing of the lyrics. You do sometimes sing your own lyrics, but then you bring in somebody like Dana Jean Phoenix. And so, before we get to Dana, there's a track on the album Before Endgame. You almost have like a Joe Cocker sound to it, where it's a little gravelly and a little rough, but it's soulful. So I'm struggling to find which one that was, but how do you envision your sound? How do you like to, get your lyrics out?
So in terms of my singing particularly, I started singing on my own tracks at a really late part of my musical career, or in my life even. I started taking my singing seriously only recently, maybe 10 years ago or so. Before that, I was more of a backing vocals kind of guy, and I really didn't think of myself of like doing a particularly good job of singing them. But there was this eureka moment when I was singing stuff in my car, and I thought to myself, well, this doesn't sound half bad, in the sense of I should maybe start working on myself much more in terms of my singing voice to bring myself to the point that I'm maybe able to sing my own stuff. Because as much as I enjoy having singers over, I would feel a much more sense of satisfaction from my own music when the person that is singing it would be me. So it was definitely a process. I think the Endgame was the album that I sang at a serious, when I took my voice seriously for the first time. And I was quite surprised by the raspiness, because up until that moment, I wasn't really singing seriously. So when I did start singing seriously, it came to me as a surprise, the tone and the color of the voice. And it's still a process, like making peace with your own singing voice. I feel like for me it's a lifelong process, and I can only applaud singers that have been doing it and putting themselves out there and putting their heart on the line when they perform, when they go live on stage, etc. To me, it's a gargantuan task to feel as much acceptance towards your own singing voice. To me, it's a huge process for someone who's been a playing musician throughout all their life, but really didn't pick up singing until a very later part of their life, at a much more conscious age. But I'm definitely doing it in a way that is much more flowing, and trying not to be judgmental towards myself. Recently, it's been happening in a much easier and an easygoing sort of process for me. So I'm really happy about that fact. I try to bring out more of my voice with every coming release, if it makes sense. A lot of times, I write stuff that don't make sense for me to sing, so I do like bringing in a guest singer for that purpose. But yeah, I've been finding myself comfortable more and more throughout the years with the stuff that I write.
Well, there's something mysterious. I feel like I've known you all my life. Which is a lyric, by the way, which Alex sings so soulfully. And it balances out the times when you do have a Dana or Frank music, because there are times where, me plus you, easiest calculation, that's a really catchy lyric or catchy line. But
It's a
you're
Dana
right.
lyric.
What was that?
It's a Dana lyric, by the way. She did
Oh,
most of
okay.
it. Yeah.
Okay, well, I mean, but that makes sense, because you do have that the balance between what's heavier, what sounds good with the music, and then sometimes it's catchy, peppy, and it needs a higher caliber of a voice. So excellent work. You could tell I'm a fan, by the way. Hopefully.
I truly appreciate that. And again, for having me over, I'm humbled and thankful.
Excellent. Well, as we were talking about the touring, what is the availability, possibility, desire to tour? And, it's great that you can see these artists. I got to see Delta Sleep, who is kind of another Bandcamp titan, a lot like yourself, different musicality. But that's another one that sometimes you see the album and you go, yeah, whoever makes this, I gotta see. There's gotta be something to it. I found a lot of artists just, being lured in by the artwork. So sorry, rambling. What's going on in the touring world?
So touring world has been kind of on hiatus for the past couple of years. I think the last show I've done was about 2 years ago here locally in Israel. I would be really happy to get back on the road with Highway Superstar. However, I'm also trying to figure out the next steps in kind of putting more music out there to have more stuff to showcase in a live scenario as well. So I'm mindful of that. I would definitely be happy to do some shows in Europe, outside of Europe, in the States and Canada as well. So it's definitely on the cards. It's just the challenges of obviously making it happen.
Sure. Well, logistically, let's say you got the perfect set list, you got the perfect touring schedule. How do you bring these artists who make the tracks so special? I mean, do you need to travel with all of them? Can you find, local players, or the things that you feel like you can do all by yourself? How does a Highway Superstar concert actually work?
So in terms of Highway Superstar's live shows, I would say it's very modular in the sense of I can have a full-on five-piece band up on stage with a guitar player, a drummer, a bass player, myself, and a female singer. So Sharon, who I've collaborated with in the last album, Contraband, she's been actually my go-to live singer throughout the period of Highway Superstar's live iteration. She's been doing all the female vocal parts. I've been doing all the male vocal parts, and we've been kind of doing it as a duo. We've done similar shows in that kind of format, with me being on keyboards, her being on vocals, in pretty much all of the shows that we've played abroad so far. We've done that in Sweden, we've done that in Russia, we've done that in the UK as well, in London. Simply because of the logistics involved with bringing a full piece band abroad. Here in Israel, it's much more easy for me to bring a fully fledged live band to the mix. But yeah, as we go, as time goes by, and in the future, I would definitely be interested in bringing more of that kind of full band experience on the road. And yeah, definitely hope that happens.
All right. Well, as we await that, we're going to say keep those sweet synths coming. Alex, stay safe. Thank you for your music. Thank you for bringing such collaborators together to make the sounds we love. To take us out of this interview, can you give us Alex Kurlinski's 10 favorite things?
10 favorite things. All right, let's...
And it could be anything. Just preface it. No wrong answer. It could be anything.
So let's start with my Juno 106 synthesizer. That would be my first favorite thing. I would say headphones would be the second. Probably high-top sneakers.
Reebok pumps?
Reebok pumps. Yeah, let's go with Reebok pumps. That would be the third. Vinyl records. Vinyl records would absolutely be somewhere at the top. Can't live without them. Vinyls, turntables, with all of this world, but let's stick to vinyl and 12-inch for that matter. So that's my studio monitors. Another thing I can't really live without. If I would pick one of my guitars, it would probably be my Telecaster. So we'll go with the Telecaster.
Well, don't say that too loud. Your other guitars might feel jealous, but
it's okay. They're getting enough mileage from me, so I'm fairly confident. Let's see. I would probably, in terms of video games, I would probably pick the PS5.
Okay.
Again, we're talking about things. I would probably go with something like my trusty Casio watch.
Don't leave home without it.
Yeah. And how much do we have left?
We've got two more.
Two more. Aviator sunglasses.
Ooh, nice. Those? Is that the one that you have in your profile pic? When I got your email, it just has you in some nice shades.
Sadly, no. I am prone to losing sunglasses everywhere I go, but I always get aviators. So, yeah.
That's a look that defines a generation. That's, yeah. That's
a good look. Way of getting lost.
All right, one more. Could it be the drive poster behind you? Could it be, I don't know. You said monitors. I don't know, one more, could be anything. I know you can do it. Alex.
Well, I will go with this, which is something you can't live without in Israel. And this is the AC remote.
Oh, wow.
If you don't have a chilly studio to work in, what do you have?
You got a lot of sweat, and your perspiration yields no music.
I would much rather sweat during a tennis match or so, but studio needs to be kept chilly and nice and cool.
Frigid fingers make the best musical notes. So, well, everyone, let's thank Highway Superstar for his time. You've got a license to drive, so hit the gas, hit play, and we will catch you next time. Thanks, Alex.
Thanks, man.